It is always interesting whenever we have guests on. Some people, I suppose, a little bit of variety in how much setup some people need to do. There's a couple faction people who have, like, done streaming before, and so they just have all these set up.
Oh, okay, so it's a really easy start to ease into the cast.
Yeah, or just someone like Nath or even Hoodie, they just have all this equipment sitting around already set up.
Yeah, I think I actually do have a better mic than my just like standard phone one that would actually do a recording, but then it's like messing around with memory cards to get it out and all those kinds of classic things. I used to use it to record D&D sessions, actually, that we played.
Oh, that's cool.
Occasionally it was fun to, yeah, go back and listen to them.
So, by the way, this is the Faction Podcast. We've had a request that we actually do the intro at the start, which is a reasonable request, to be honest. So there you go, Jonesy. We'll do the intro at the start. I'm Ian. Pete is our guest today, and Trent's also here.
I am here.
Hi, everybody.
So that's interesting. So you used to play D&D and record sessions.
Yeah. It actually was pretty handy for keeping notes in certain circumstances or going back and hearing cool things. There was actually one campaign when we had a go at the classic, I think it's called Keep on the Borderlands, and a friend of mine had, well, actually a fellow faction member, one of the Dans ran a group of about six of us through a whole series of adventures of Keep on the Borderlands that have been kind of reskinned for a more modern version of D&D, and that was a huge amount of fun. Unfortunately, we missed, I think we didn't record the very first session, which involved this crazy battle sequence at the end of it. So that was a bit disappointing, but the rest of it we captured for posterity, as it were, and to go back and listen to a few years down the track. Yeah.
So that's super cool on two levels. Firstly, it's cool to be able to go back and listen to those things, I imagine. But as a DM, I would also appreciate doing that, because I've definitely had times where we got to the next session and I didn't take good enough notes, and I now can't remember who has the key item or what the players know or, you know, those sort of things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. I didn't realize you DM. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've done a few campaigns, often with people who are a little bit less experienced with D&D, so possibly slightly loose on rules and more focus on storytelling and, you know, like making things work in a way that sounds reasonable. A lot more like, what do you want to do? Okay, let me work out roughly how that would work in the rules, rather than, you know, people who know every inch of their character and the large rule book. D&D has a very large rule book.
Yeah, it's definitely about finding a group with the style you gel with, and it's like, my group mostly, for example, still plays 3.5, so one of the earlier editions, and I think we tried two sessions of fourth, decided it wasn't for us, and I think I had a bit of a go at fifth ed, and again, it's kind of like, well, when you've already spent, like, you know, 15, 20 years playing with a rule set, and now I'm making myself sound very, very old, you kind of just, like, know how stuff works and how you can expect the interactions to work, and you're all kind of familiar with it, and it's just easy, and it's kind of like, well, we actually want to spend time playing the game, not learning the rules, so kind of works well, and so long as it works well enough for what you're trying to do, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I don't know, Trent, I don't know how much role-playing you've played, but I have a similar thing, and you might also have, with 40K, which we talked about last week, whenever a new edition came out, and having to, like, relearn the rules.
Yeah, I guess so. I think when I was playing Warhammer, the rules didn't dramatically change between editions. Like, it wasn't massive shake-up, so it was pretty easy to learn them. I haven't played a whole lot of Dungeons & Dragons. I've, like, done it once or twice for a couple of sessions, but, like, just casually, or filling in for someone, or, like, playing because my housemates, as I said, needed a fill-in. But I don't know. It's interesting to me, actually. I don't even know how the rules could be so different, but then again, it's a fantasy game, so you could, you know, basically do it, rewrite them however you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I guess, we're not a D&D podcast.
We are now.
only takes a matter of time to turn around. I've actually been surprised how many people in the faction are involved in D&D, which is really stupid considering the natural overlap between like D&D players and Magic players. You know, it's not one for one, but most people will have given it a go as, you know, a game being gamers of some sort or another, right? So I don't know why I'm surprised by it when it happens. But yeah, the rules, I guess, kind of just shift. It's I'm just trying to think of the good analogy. It's kind of like they often try and retain the spirit of what they do, and you know, these are role-playing game companies, right? So they're trying to make a bit of cash from releasing the new edition and drawing in new players with a bit of a different style and those kinds of things as well. So yeah, they can change. They can change pretty dramatically, though. Some systems is just like a straight like cleanup of, hey, we were doing it this dumb way, now we can do it this like essentially just a cleaner and more readily understandable way that now it's actually being play tested a lot out in the real world. So
yeah, I can understand that for sure.
Yeah, I think certainly a couple of the earlier editions of Shadowruns, they were more evolutionary than revolutionary in the mix. Much like, I guess, Magic sets are often can feel that way too. Like sometimes they're going completely new directions, and sometimes you suddenly have square brackets all over your cards and you're trying to figure out what they mean on the fly as you're reading through them in a draft.
Yeah, don't like that.
Yeah, I don't feel Cleave is maybe the most elegantly executed mechanic ever. And yeah, it's not bad, but it's just kind of like,
Oh, it's a great mechanic. It's just complete dog shit to read.
Yeah.
To try and understand it, especially if you're doing a draft or something and other people are waiting on you.
Yeah, yeah, and it kind of kills a bit to me that, like, elegance of the cards, in a sense. Though then again, I think having played Magic for a very long time, I remember when they first started putting, like, those little bracketed rules text reminder, and I was like, what? You can't just remember all your keywords? And now, you know, as time has gone on, I'm like, oh, thank goodness they do that, because most of the time you can get enough of the gist of mechanic from that to have a good feel for how it'll play.
Yeah, I feel like it's much less overwhelming when you can pick up an Eldrazi card that's got 42 power and 42 toughness and it costs 42 mana, but at least when it tells you what Annihilator does, you understand what it does, as opposed to a word in brackets that says Cleave with a mana cost next to it and then no explanation about Cleave.
Yeah, yeah. Though I think they tend to reserve that stuff more for the rare and mythic side of things. Like, their assumption is if you're encountering that level of card, I think you're assumed to be a more invested player and more likely to know what's going on, or it's rare enough for the casual player to encounter them. But I don't know. There's a lot of interesting bits and pieces on Magic design, how they make the game good and accessible and clear to people, and it's... yeah, there's not actually that much space in that text box to work with, so I'm willing to appreciate anybody who puts a lot of time and effort thinking about it, and sometimes feels like less time and effort than others.
Yeah, yeah. I do think there's also something to say about mechanics that feel more flavorful. We talked about this a little bit with Blood the other week, but some mechanics I feel like they fit the flavor so well that helps you understand them almost, like Annihilator, for example, right? I sort of understand what's being represented by these giant Eldrazi attacking and just like ruining the world in front of them in a much more, I suppose, satisfying way than Cleave.
Yeah, it's almost visceral in a sense when you see the word Annihilator, and it's like, oh, you're sacrificing, you've got your opponent sacrificing permanence when you attack, and it's like, okay, yeah, that kind of all makes sense. I mean, to me, the most beautiful examples of those are things like some of the very original keywords, obviously you leave banning aside, but stuff like flying and first strike. It's just like, oh, first strike. It deals the damage before everything else. Like,
yeah,
that's such a clear metaphor for the game. Or trample. It's like, okay, you've crushed the creature in front of you. Have you gone on and you've damaged the mage behind them? Like,
yeah. I think flying is actually a great example you mentioned. I think that's so intuitive. It's like, oh, well, my bird creature flies, so it can't be blocked by your goblin. You know, that makes so much sense and is so intuitive.
Yeah. And I get that, you know, there's I guess, a somewhat limited amount of clean keyword space that they have to work with for these various things. So treasure, for example, like treasure tokens, those feel to me kind of like, you know, clues, treasures and blood, kind of almost the cleanest implementations. Like, oh, I've got this little bit of thing I can trade in for some mana. So it's like, you know, I've got this token I can go and get some mana with, which to me is actually a nicer implementation than something, say, like a clue or a blood token where you've kind of got to pay some mana and do something and manipulate your hand and things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of a bit more involved in the sacrifice process.
Yep, totally fair. And, of course, we mentioned Cleave and reading cards during drafts because this weekend we had the Good Games Greensboro Store Championship, I think it was. I don't remember the exact terminology, but it was a effectively single elimination event with 32 players, a draft event with $1,000 for first prize. So the three of us all played. I had one of the better records, which is to say I lost my first match and immediately went to the pub. But you both did a little bit better than me.
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting one. And I think I'm curious to see how many times Trent calls me a coward in this podcast. So it'll be a bit interesting as it develops. So I had a slightly different path than you, Ian. So I won my first one. I got a draw, which, you know, then necessitated a whole bundle of people playing a third round because we couldn't do a clean cut in our pod.
It did, yeah, it did. I don't think you were the only pod. I think one of the pods had seven, so they just inherently had a draw. And then I think two of the pods maybe had unintentional draws, which just massively complicated everything. Rather than being effectively single elimination, which is what it would be with no draws, instead there was a lot of, I guess I'll keep playing and hope my tiebreakers are better.
Yeah. And what was your path to the top eight, Trent? Did you have a nice clean run of winning through?
Yeah, so Ian touched on having the best record of 0-1 drop. I had the worst record of making top eight, refusing to split, and then losing my round.
Mm.
So it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I believe your first draft deck was very powerful, and you didn't have too much trouble in the first two rounds.
No, I think that my draft was kind of, I was rewarded in my draft by putting my head in the my head down and my bum up and listening to a bunch of podcasts and just like doing my due diligence of the format, understanding what cards were good and what cards you should be taking in drafts. And I was rewarded with, I think, just drafting well and then, yeah, obviously understanding the format maybe a little bit better than some of the people in my pod. And that just led to pretty clean games, no mulligans, and yeah, pretty swift entry into the top eight, which was comforting and confidence boosting.
Yeah, I think important to note that there was varying levels of experience, both with this specific draft format and also just drafting in general. I know one person in my pod, we sat down and he immediately said, "Oh, I haven't drafted since Gatecrash."
Yeah, it's an interesting one that like, diversity of experience in that tournament, because the interesting thing is obviously in the lead to this tournament a lot of the events that people were qualifying through were constructed events as well, so notwithstanding that, I guess means you don't necessarily have people who have that same level of interest or experience in limited magic as much. Now I certainly didn't have experience with this format, but I've, you know, been fortunate enough to draft a fair bit and play a number of, like, you know, CLGPs and things. But for me, probably the strangest thing in a way was just, this is kind of the first time I picked up physical cards and played with them for about kind of maybe 5 or 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Probably since like one of those early qualifier events, really. So we got in some good drafts in Kaldheim at the start of the year, and then I don't think I I don't think I saw much in during Forgotten Realms, and now we kind of rounded out into this set of pods. So I think I had an interesting pod. I had a couple of fellow faction members in my pod that I was lucky enough to drop to dodge, I guess. So Braden and Shane, who are both pretty great on the draft front. And I think they both faced each other in the second round, which was the round I drew in. So they were kind of in a position where one of them was going to knock the other out, which wasn't great.
They did. And I believe Braden then was the victim of your draw because he was 2-0, but got paired down and had to play in the third round rather than getting a clean draw in. And he lost and finished, I believe, 9th.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, 9th, yep.
That'll make sense.
Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, bit of break of luck is always part of Magic events, for better or for worse.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And sometimes, so for me, it felt like it was just my first round was, I just drafted a very, what I thought was kind of, you know, fairly ordinary deck within my pod. It didn't feel particularly, I had one of these stupid busted rares for the format, which seems to be this, what is it, the Helena and someone companions. Sorry, I'm just going to flick through cards till I see it again.
I honestly could not tell you the name of that card. It's Helena and something, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's two red, green, here it is. Helena and Alina partners.
All right, yeah.
Two red, green, 2/3, first strike reach, which is all good. It's a legendary creature. But the thing that's crazy about it is you put X plus one counters on another target creature you control, where X is Helena and Alina's power, and that creature gains haste until end of turn. So it kind of lands, pumps up an attack, and then unless it's dealt with basically instantly, it can take over a game very, very quickly in a draft-style format. So I guess its toughness is that it's a 2/3, so, you know, it's not the toughest creature out there and probably dies to a lot of the spot removal at more common rarities. But, yeah, it just feels like, for a rare, it feels just like crazy good in a limited setting.
Yeah, it's one of the somewhat large class of cards in this format that if you don't answer them very quickly, they just take over the game. And at least in this case, this one is reasonably answerable. There's a decent number of commons that remove it, but if you don't do it very quickly, it just buries you.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of say I think I just had a lot of luck that day because I don't know Trent's, it'd be interesting to hear kind of Trent's opinion on it, but certainly the top eight kind of very much felt like a draft where most people sitting around the table, and I'll count myself in that number, didn't really know the format. And it was quite swingy and it felt quite, I don't know, the power level wasn't obvious to me coming through, and I wasn't sure if that's kind of a format piece or more of a, just how the packs kind of broke out in that round.
I suppose we should to clarify that you ended up winning your quarterfinals, and then I believe the top four all split prizes, right?
Yeah, that's what ended up happening. So I think it was about four-ish at that point. I had some stuff on in the evening, D&D actually, funnily enough. which is somehow appropriate given the lead-in on this podcast, and probably while I was thinking about it a bit, and I was kind of like, oh, well, if everyone else is keen to split, the important thing is we get a faction T-shirt in the photo, right? So it had been kind of a good fun day just getting to catch up with people again and playing some games, and I certainly did way better than I expected going to the tournament given my level of familiarity with the format.
Mm-hmm. So on that top eight draft, I know I watched this and I've talked to Trent a little bit and also a couple of the other top eight drafters. It did seem like a bit of a weird draft. Would that be fair to say?
I think it absolutely was. To me, it kind of felt there wasn't a very kind of there weren't really clear signals coming through, because I don't know, I was just trying to do kind of, you know, relatively straightforward stuff. And I think my first in for like in pack one, I think I went like a braid, because there just wasn't anything kind of more exciting to me in those packs. And again, that might just be not knowing the format. And then I think I had the black red vampire. It's a 3/2. It creates a blood token when it comes into play, and you can sacrifice it to give a creature neg one equal to twice as many as the number of blood tokens you have, I think is the ability.
Yeah, Blood Tithe Harvester. The gold uncommon.
So I kind of took that, and then that kind of pushed me into that black-red space. But then it's kind of like I didn't feel much was coming around in the way of black or red after that point, and I kind of got to the end of pack one, and I counted my creatures, and I had four creatures, which is maybe not where you want to be at the end of your first pack in a draft. So,
yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes coming out of pack one especially, you had 10 strong spells and the spells were stronger than the creatures, but it is certainly something that you have to realize after pack one and shift your priorities a little bit. Trent, how did you feel about the draft?
It was definitely one of the tougher drafts I've done in this format, probably the toughest. I'd push back on saying that people at the table weren't confident or knew what they were doing with the format. I think that a lot of the consensus with this format is that the very good commons and uncommons stand out head and shoulders above the rest. So when multiple people open up packs that don't include these commons and uncommons that are more powerful than all the others by, you know, a fair amount, it makes the packs very flat in regards to power level. That also makes it difficult to identify where you're supposed to be in the draft. What colors are open? What are the best cards in the pack? If everything is very even, then it's very hard for everybody to find different lanes because there's no signals. So a few people will find signals because obviously like they pick up, you know, they open a bomb rare or one of the best uncommons or commons in the set. Like for instance, you straddled into red pretty easily because you opened a braid, which is, you know, arguably the best red, well, arguably one of the best commons in the set, and you get two of them. It's like, okay, you get to saddle into red pretty easy, pretty happy with your picks because you've got two of the premier commons. If you were to look at my draft, though, obviously I can say it from experience, I didn't get any good cards that were able to yell at me and say, you should be in this color, this is a signal, like, you need to be here. And that makes that makes drafts really enjoyable because you then have to push back on, or so like, not push back, you have to rely on your own intuition and ability to navigate difficult drafts. You have to think outside the box about how you're going to make this flat power pack that is constantly coming work. And that's really interesting because anyone can draft on rails. If anyone can look they take 3 minutes out of their day, look at 17 lands or just listen to a podcast, it's very simple to understand. Or just read a Magic card. You know, if you've played limited Magic, you understand that a Braid is an extremely good card. Bleed Dry is an insanely good card. Like, you know what, when a 6 power 6/6 is in a pack, it's probably a good card. So, navigating those murky waters is much more interesting and much more difficult.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting you say that because that makes me feel kind of a bit more confident about how I kind of navigated that draft then as well, because I'm trying to think of how to describe it. It was almost a little bit core set like in that, to that point around having quite a balanced flat power level. And I think the way I was dealing with that in the first pack, of the top eight draft was really, once I had that kind of, I'm clearly in red, was I basically took most of the red, like a lot of red cards I saw, simply to try and to the extent I could send in some sort of signal, send things that way. So I think I only ended up with like 3 or 4 non-red cards out of that first pack, which is, again, was trying to leave myself a bit open to go into the second and third, because I was like, well, maybe I'll get a bit of a clearer signal at those points.
Yeah, and I'll say I watched Pete's draft for the most part, and also a little bit the people either side of you, and I did think Pete and that side of the table found their lanes pretty easily on, and it sounds like Trent, who was, you're roughly opposite Pete, I think, and I know talking to Nathan Jones, who was next to you, he also struggled with finding his lane and just, yeah, sort of not having super clear signals early on.
So there was the very clear signal for me was that Vampires was not open, that Red was not open. So my first pick was Ange, Maid of Dishonor, which is the black-red legendary vampire. And my second pick was Mark of Retribution, which is the best red uncommon removal, well, the best red uncommon for vampires. And after that, I didn't see a single red card worth taking for multiple picks. And the black cards, which thankfully were deep enough, I took I took Gluttonous Geist third, and then took a good green card over Vampire Socialite in pack 4 because of that power level disparity that I was talking about before. I know that from the information that I was told that Infestation in Expert is quite a good card, whereas Bloodcrazed Socialite is merely a fine card. And so I ended up in green, I believe correctly so. My green cards were, whilst all flat level, they were all quite good commons and some good uncommons. But it was still tough. Like it's hard to get in those spots where, say, for instance, you like as I did, I open up one of the top five winning percentage cards in the format, and then I get past the best red uncommon, and it's like, okay, well, blinders are up, blinders are on. We're just going to draft vampires, and then I could have taken the Gluttonous Geist, the Bloodcrazed Socialite. I think there was a pretty bad black card in pack 5 as well that was a vampire, or it might have been the removal spell. Either way, it's like it's tough because the signals are saying red isn't open, and it makes perfect sense. You were 3 to my right, and I knew that Nathan Jones also valued red quite highly, so there's a fair chance that it's just not there. So getting away from it is the tough part.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. So did you, because I'm just thinking, I can't remember what my fourth or fifth pick was, but I feel one of those two was like the, not Daybreak, Combatants, the other two, three, Fearful Villager, the 2/3 Menace Werewolf, which is obviously like a double face card. Now, I know I at least was too busy reading cards and trying to figure out what was going on to kind of pay too much to kind of have that kind of corner of your eye awareness on, is someone laying down a double face card? But I don't know to what extent you see that stuff, or is it just so much eyes front from years of good habits of drafting that doesn't even kind of spring to mind even in a format like this?
The correct answer is to say that I drafted the way you should, and that is by looking at your packs and looking nowhere else at the table. So the correct answer is to say, no, I did not see your Fearful Villager, and I had no idea that you were drafting red.
Yeah. I was, like I said, just curious.
And I just want to say, I know I discussed this with Nath, who was in my pod for the first draft, and that was one of our big complaints about how this event was run, was that there was no clarity on how we were doing that. So, and the way that usually works in competitive drafts is you, not only do you, so everyone opens their packs and actually you have to go around and reveal what your card is, and you're also supposed to declare whenever you draft a double face card, so that you don't have to look around and there's not this weird game of like trying to watch other people draft and that. You actually are meant to declare it, at least in, I don't know what official REL that kicks in at, I know it's true of like GP day twos, for example.
I think you're right that it's definitely a professional. I'm not sure if it's competitive or not. I would have thought so. I mean, I was kind of, how to put it, I think I was very eyes front on this, just reading cards and drafting my packs. I certainly couldn't name what color you were in from anything you were doing, Trent. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, right? But, yeah, it would have been nice if the judge had said, this is how this is being handled, or...
Yeah.
It's definitely a competitive REL as to which you're supposed to go around the table and show that you've drafted your things. But yeah, eyes down, eyes on your packs. The only three packs you look at is the pack you pass, the pack in front of you, and the pack you receive.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And I guess competitive REL doesn't require time because, like, time drafts, I've done a few of them before, and some, to be honest, part of the thing I actually enjoy about a time draft, like I would have struggled with this, but I think they're actually really valuable in those more competitive settings, not only because it keeps the draft moving at pace, which I think is quite important, but also because you don't get the opportunity to practice them very much kind of properly with people, where you do have that pressure of 3, 2, 1, draft, put down, count out your pack, check you have this many cards, pick up your pack.
It's one of the coolest things I remember about the Nationals that we had was that it was one of the rare opportunities we got, given how few GPs we have and not all of us are playing on the PT. Nationals was one of the few opportunities we got to do timed or called drafts.
Yeah.
Yep. It's great points that you raise, and you're very much correct. Time drafts are fantastic because this is $1,000 tournament, so I suppose like you can chalk that up to whatever you want. $1,000 is still equivalent to an RPTQ invite, like, so, you know, for a few years back. So
it's real stakes, right? It's just real stakes involved in the game, and should be treated as such.
And that's exactly right. And you know, a time draft also tests those skills and abilities of you as a drafter to say, do you deserve to win? Like, are you able to make these decisions under pressure? Have you practiced this? Okay, you haven't had the chance to practice this. Well, now's your chance to practice it. So next time it comes around, you're going to be better at it. So, yeah, yeah. I was a little disappointed we didn't have a time draft. I was a little disappointed in, you know, the way that the day was run, like in regards to, you know, just the announcements and stuff. But look, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. We all got to play Magic, you know, get to see a lot of my friends and have a beer at the pub. And, you know, it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was fantastic.
Oh, I'm really glad they ran the series and kind of got it rolling. Because certainly I kind of wonder what would have happened if we hadn't had kind of the further rounds of lockdowns in a lot of ways. So I was actually quite, at the start of the year, I was like super excited. I was like, I need to be playing in events to qualify. I was getting out to events after I qualified to try and, you know, support the team. And hey, they're good runs of events out of the store championship series and things. And to have this thing to go, hey, how many people in the team can kind of work together and get into this tournament at the end of the year. And I feel, you know, the faction had a really good showing into this tournament, right, in a lot of positive ways. And we had a great mix of people from around the broader Melbourne community as well, who I think were quite excited by it too. But it just lost momentum for me during all that time not playing Paper Magic is the really honest kind of statement. Like, I almost had to go, it was almost like a surprise, oh, they're actually still running this. Because I think Braden was the first one that contacted me out of about three people in the team. I think Braden was the first one to contact me and said, hey, have you seen they're actually running this on the 10th?
Yeah, I have to agree. I had kind of assumed they'd just, like so many other things during COVID, it had just been cancelled. And I didn't expect it to actually end up running, and I know they ran it slightly abridged in terms of not quite as many qualifiers as I think they had planned to run it initially.
Yeah, and I think they kind of found some sort of approach to kind of fill out the numbers in there. So they had the pretty much a full 32. It's one of those things. It's almost like, do you have like a reserve spot or something for the fact that, you know, one or two people might drop out and not be able to make it on the day, kind of thing. But then are you just wasting those people who are kind of in those reserve slots kind of time by doing that? I mean, there's no easy answers for those situations, I feel, for a tournament organizer.
It's true. I must admit, I am slightly more critical than Trent of some of the way this was run, and just it honestly felt like it was run like to the level that I would expect, like a game day or, you know, a PPTQ maybe, or not even a PPTQ to be run, rather than a tournament with $1,000 cash, which I feel like maybe warranted some more heightened levels of organization and of, you know, competitive rigor, I guess.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I definitely agree with you, but at the same time, once the announcement was made for regular REL / competitive REL, everyone that understood that statement had a problem with it, and no one put up their hand to say that they had a problem with it, even though they did. So at the end of the day, you know, we can say, you know, oh, it could have been done better, or it could have been, you know, could have been run differently. But we as players also weren't accountable towards that when we realized that that is not how we would have liked the tournament to run, or how we thought the tournament would have been run. So, you know, it does go both ways. I understand that it starts from the top, but we also adhered to... Sorry, my mother's dog is snoring. So if you can hear this, like, weird sound in the back, that is most definitely my lovely mother's dog. Sorry, I don't know if you can hear it, but if you can, it's hilarious.
No, it's not coming through the mic to me, but yeah, it's like, tis a fine dog, but tis no Murph kind of thing, right?
Nah, Murph's here somewhere. He's asleep somewhere else. They've tired himself out all day. But yeah, as I was saying, like we are to be held to the same, well, maybe not to the same level, but we are also accountable for the way that the tournament is held if we have a problem with it. And I think going forward, that's something that can be important for stores that are starting up again that haven't or maybe have lost that kind of tournament equity or understanding of how competitive REL tournaments were run, you know, years back.
I think you're absolutely right on that front, Trent. And it's just that natural, I think there's that natural, I'm trying to think of the right word, like hesitancy when you're part of a group that seems to be accepting something to do something different to that group. And even if most of the group agrees and you think most of the group agrees, there's also, it's that natural balance of, well, it is kind of their event to run. And it's their event to run as they see fit. And so it is finding that balance. And it's very hard to kind of stand up out of the group to kind of raise a concern around that, even though you're absolutely right. There is a way to respectfully put that position forward to them in kind of those opening stages before any packs have been opened, and kind of raise that as a point of discussion, like at that stage. So it's a you know, we get the events we seek as a community, I guess, is the thing to recognize there. And if we don't kind of, you know, respectfully raise that point and accept whatever the tournament organizer's decision is in response to it, they don't necessarily get the opportunity to get that feedback.
Yeah, that's what I would say, is that I think I can understand not raising it, especially during the event. I know, at least for me, it's like, if that's the way they've decided to run it, I'm not going to push back on the day, because I think that just can create a lot of confusion. And, you know, at that point, it's like, that's what they've decided. But it is the sort of thing that I think is valuable feedback for stores potentially, especially as we sort of move back into actually running events, which we haven't really had very much of for the last 2 years. And ultimately, as Trent said, it was just really good to play Paper Magic and see my friends and go to the pub and cheer on, you know, my teammates in the top eight. So it's still a really good day.
Yeah, and it's not as if, I don't think there was anyone there with ill intentions. I don't think anyone was trying to shark or angle anybody. I think everybody understood the you know, the certain levels of different experience in the room, especially, you know, when people are opening packs, like you said, Ian, when you had somebody say that they hadn't dropped it since Gatecrash. Like, I think that people were, I'll use the term respectful of that, and there weren't any major issues, none that I've seen anyway.
Yeah, I certainly felt, how to put it, it definitely felt like more than a casual draft, if that makes sense. Like, even though it was kind of regarial for that opening section, it kind of felt, okay, everyone was around the table, was basically pretty quiet or silent. Everyone just focused on their packs and drafting well. So to me, that was a really positive outcome.
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a different atmosphere, which was very cool.
Yeah, it certainly felt like it was an event that mattered, which was, to me, the nicest feeling about the whole thing, to be honest. Well, maybe not the nicest. The nicest was getting to catch up with people again after, you know, not seeing some of them for probably 6 months or so.
I thought you were going to say the nicest thing was the $250 you won.
That was probably actually the third nicest thing in the event, which was why I was willing to be a coward and dive into the price split, because I felt I'd kind of gotten what I wanted for out of the day.
Yeah.
With the biggest highlight kind of, you know, getting to the top eight at all, because like I said, when I've always feel with draft, it's very, yes, there's a bit of luck involved, but it's so skill intensive in terms of that understanding of the format and having that broader understanding of how games are going to play out in particular circumstance. So it was kind of like, even how to put it, I was kind of pared down in my third round. So I was playing someone who had a one win and one loss, I think. So if I hadn't won that third round, we both would have been out. And it's kind of interesting in those circumstances, because it's like, oh yeah, you can game theory it out. And I was like, well, you know what? This guy can read the stats as well as I can. He's keen to have a game of Magic. Let's play a round of Magic and kind of just see how it kind of works through. And he had a really interesting blue-white spirits deck that got me good in the second game with the crazy, I think it's a one white three drop that has Tar Star equal the number of spirits and enchantments you control. So he played that thing turn four as like a 5/5. Yeah, it was kind of like, oh, and then that game I just was dead. And then, but I did enjoy the fact that then, like, the next game I was like, okay, so how do I deal into the fact that I know he has that? And so the way I played game three was kind of significantly different, just trying to do the most to keep the board clear and things, or hold back removal in such a way that I was, that thing would be manageable if he did play it again. And I guess to the extent I've been playing Magic in that intervening period, it had been on Arena, so it's a lot of best of one. And it's so easy to just choose to do best of one and go, it's only 20 minutes, even though you know you're going to probably be sitting down for an hour playing Magic anyway, and you actually do have time to do a proper best of three game. Because it's just like leaving yourself that optionality a little, as opposed to committing to a full, like, you know, 40, 50 minutes of playing through a proper round of Magic online. So it was nice playing sideboarded limited again, because I feel like that's something I've kind of missed, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I think that came to me in the draft format, in the draft section as well, because like you, I've played almost exclusively best of one, and there was definitely a moment in the draft where I was like, oh, actually, I should take this for my sideboard. This is a relevant sideboard card that I would almost never play in main deck in best of one, but it is actually relevant to take here.
Yeah, definitely improves things. I think, Trent, you were going to make a point.
I was just going to say it's good that you touched on that, because I think that it was very important, and I think that it might be very important for people to start playing best of three again for 2 points. The first point being best of one is complete and utter rubbish, and I've said that for a long time. And best of three, it's like, this format definitely rewards good sideboarding. Like, there's... It's interesting. I thought a lot about my top eight match with Jeff and about how I could have sideboarded and about how I could have changed. I was relatively happy with how I played the match and the decisions I made within the game, the decisions within the draft. I was happy, you know, as to where I ended up. But the sideboarding decisions, after all, I actually laid down and thought about it, and the next day I was like, I could have done so much more in my game to give myself more percentage. And I think that might just be flat true of like everyone who is being, or everyone who is or thinks they are a cognizant drafter in these formats. It's just a lot of room to wiggle. I've said it many times that, you know, the pack depth, whilst it might be flat, is that there's no cards that can't be taken. Like, they all have some kind of playability, whereas years and years and years ago, that wasn't such the case. But that means that because every card is playable, you need to assess every card in the sideboard for every different option. And I was like a victim of this. I legitimately didn't do that. And I think that if people are going to play this format more or just play limited in 2021, it is something that people need to become more aware of and more comfortable with.
And it's absolutely, how to put it, there is a real thrill when you go, right, I've changed, say, three or four cards in my deck, and four cards in a 40-card deck is 10% of the deck is now different, right? Like, it's actually has a far more disproportionate impact than it does in Constructed, I feel. And there's for me, always that real thrill when you go, right, this was kind of how I saw this game playing out. You kind of hit that top deck sideboard card, and you just have the right solution of having slanted your deck slightly differently to deal into a circumstance that you just wouldn't have been able to handle out otherwise. And you just feel really smart when you do that. Like, you feel like you've put in the effort, you feel like you've understood the format, and it just makes for one of those really positive feelings you get when you're playing and solving the kind of the complex puzzle that is Magic, I feel.
I totally agree.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's our last event for a little bit, I think, maybe. I know Moxing Day is coming up for the Highlander players, but I think for me at least, I'm probably looking at my next big event will be the Champs in a bit over a month now, which is coming up very quickly.
Mm. Yep, and we get to see more of this format in Champs. So that was the other reason why I was very keen to play this format in a more competitive setting, is to start getting that mindset right.
Yep, absolutely. So it'll be interesting to see that, because that's quite a late format draft, which is, it's always interesting, I think, playing, and this is true of Standard and also Draft, the difference playing something that's towards the end of the set rather than, you know, 2 weeks in or that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think this is probably the first time in a while where we've done that with either a faction champs or invitational event, because generally we're drafting the latest set, and the latest set normally comes out, for whatever reasons, tends to be like a week or two before most of these events most of the time. So it's relatively rare that we do kind of dive into a better understood format, I feel, in terms of the draft portion of the format. That's, you know, we regularly play different constructive formats in there as well, but from that draft perspective,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a really nice play, add a really nice flavor to the day, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would say quickly that this format is pretty damn deep too. It's got a huge roster of playable commons and a huge roster of how they interact with either the good commons that you always see or the lesser good commons that maybe are like 24th, 25th, 23rd, whatever. So I think that this format going long can actually have some pretty good implications about like changing draft strategies, changing pick orders and like just rewarding constantly playing the format, because I think there'll be a lot of little hidden gems in this format, which is awesome for a format, to be real. Like, it is one of the cool things about every card or the majority of cards impacts being playable, right, is that it does make the spread of information a lot wider and the game's a lot more interesting, because these cards have applications as opposed to the 11 of the 15 or the 10 of the 15 being playable and the 5 of them being complete and utter Fs.
Yeah, I mean, that to my mind really is where you get into the interesting piece of how you learn to direct your draft as you're moving through it, because it's what is the goal I'm building towards, and it's not necessarily one of the explicit themes that they've kind of built in to make really obvious, but it's like, how do I get the combination of cards that together are going to be that, even if it's only that, 5% better on this very flat power curve? Well, 5% can be more than enough to go from a 2-1 to a 3-0 kind of position, right? So I think from what you say, that's really exciting that you're seeing and feeling there's that much depth in the format, because you've obviously got, tons of experience across a wide variety of draft formats. And I think am I right in thinking you're a real lover of limited, Trent? I probably haven't had this conversation with you properly.
Yes. limited is my jam. Like, I have probably considered myself a limited drafter a lot longer than I ever thought I was, a constructed player. Like, I love limited a lot more. I like limited games. I've always liked lower powered formats. It doesn't really matter. Like, a jank cube with no powerful cards is like my bread and butter. I love that shit. So yeah, limited formats are the best. Like, I think limited formats also produce the most interesting comments,
analysis, maybe?
Yeah, analysis, like information, and they also give the best takes. Like, everybody knows that Ragavan is a busted magic card, right? Nobody's interested in talking about that because everybody knows it, but there might be a few people out there that think that Mind Leech Ghoul is not a D and it might be a C, and that's really interesting to me, and that's always been interesting to me.
Yeah, it's the fascinating thing, and it's quite interesting because I was someone who initially played a lot in high school in kind of the relatively early era of Magic, and then essentially just left the game for about 10 years probably, and the inimitable Michael Hood kind of got me back into the game, and it was via limited basically, and going, hey, you should actually try this draft thing, and we kind of got into that and then started playing a few more GPs, and then that really got me back into Magic again, was actually the limited drafting side, because it was this whole area of Magic I kind of had never experienced when I was younger, and it certainly feels much more approachable when you can kind of it's like a really nice contained way to kind of spend an evening. You don't have to worry about sourcing the cards. You just show up, you draft your packs, you play your three rounds, and you get some really good conversations, you learn some new things, and you get to explore these formats, and you get to see how cards that you would never normally interact with or never even think to play it, put in a constructed deck, just how they add to the game and what different cards and the niches that they can come through for you in.
Yeah, it's just raw, right? It's just the way it was meant to be played. Like, it's just open boosters and my cards are cool and I'm going to make them, I'm going to battle them against each other. Like, that's fucking awesome. That's just awesome. Like, sick. It's the best part of it. And as long as it's not Nathan Drew Whalen with a Blood Baron and a Kokosho, then it's going to be good. You're going to enjoy it.
Yes, or who was it I ran into? I think I actually got to play some fun sealed against Kaldheim sealed against Pack and his couple of serpents in
yeah, the pair of comas.
Yeah, that's right.
That's interesting you mentioned Hoodie sort of getting you back into the game. Am I right in saying you are one of the longest standing faction members?
I'll definitely like to. I think that's definitely right. I think I was part of the original core when Hoodie started exploring making this a real thing, and it's going to sound really bad, but I don't think I've listened to the Hoodie episode yet, where he might have gone into a bit more of the team's history and things. But yeah, I think I was definitely an original member. We attempted to be a Team Fallen Empires for a bit, to a couple of tournaments. I think Gary did us a logo for that as well. That was slightly less aligned to the Fear Factory one, and we kind of joked around in that as being a team. But then when Preston kind of came into being, and we started playing quite regularly there. I think it was one of the following events we kind of focused on trying to forge a bit more of that team dynamic, and I think myself, Hoodie, Gary, Dan Weeble, and then Rob Fischloos and Matt Younger. And Rob's probably shouting into the podcast about how non-Dutchman can't pronounce his surname at the moment. But we kind of like teamed up and dove into a, I'm trying to think, the battle for Zendikar. I think that was the one where the expeditions first came out. Cause I have a very clear memory of, I brought up like two boxes of Battle for Zendikar for us to do practice before the event. Like we deliberately arrived like 2 days before to kind of sit down and do some practice sealed as much as we could going into this. And I distinctly remember sitting in the apartment having a conversation with Hoodie about, that's fine, Hoods, don't worry about it. Don't worry about paying for the cards. Just open them up and give me what's there. And he opened one of those Scalding Tarn expeditions that were worth stupid amounts of money at the time. It's like, well, okay, that worked out for me.
Yeah, they're worth even more stupid amounts of money now, I think.
I've got no idea. I think I ended up, but that got involved in a pretty fun and crazy trade for a Time Warp, where I think I traded away that plus most of my modern deck at the time for one of these like classic iconic Power 9 cards.
That sounds like a very good trade for you, looking back now.
Oh, looking back, it was definitely a very good trade. But at the time, it was just like, oh, I get to trade for this ridiculous historical Magic card that I never thought I'd ever own, kind of thing. So it's just funny how circumstances sometimes comes together in that front.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was kind of us as a group, and then basically we kept finding good Magic players with kind of different perspectives on the game, different fun ideas who we enjoyed hanging out with, and building like a fun culture to kind of dive in and compete amongst the broader Melbourne Magic scene. So I guess that's the other fundamental piece. Like, it's nice being able to turn up to these sometimes long and extensive events, and having that small group that you can always have a chat with between rounds and play around with ideas around the game as well.
Mm-hmm. It was very cool having, I think we had about 10 people there, and it was very cool just arriving and seeing all the shirts, basically.
Yeah, I kind of wonder how it would have felt. And the nice thing was, clearly the pods were pretty well distributed, because I think we ended up with like two or three people in each of the pods. So it was, I just kind of wonder though, if it looked like we'd kind of dived into the event a little too hard, maybe we should have just made sure we changed up the colours on the shirts a bit more broadly, because I think everyone was pretty much in their yellow, even Nate, which is unusual.
Yeah. I did enjoy also there were a couple of like commander players towards the end, and I overheard them kind of going, what are all the shirts about? And going like, did everyone just buy from like the same merchandise, or is it a team shirt, or like what's going on?
So it's always good to create some questions in people's mind with your branding, I guess. So
Fear Factor is a hell of a drug.
They assumed we were called Team Fact or Fiction, which almost.
Yeah, I could see that. I am personally a big fan of flight facilities as well, so that makes me feel a bit better that we weren't the only ones to kind of come to the conclusion of what you do when you've got two, what to do with an F and a logo.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely been very good times, and I've really enjoyed, like. And I don't know how often other people in the team think of it, but for me, one of the really valuable parts of the team is the breadth of people I get to meet and interact with, because I've got a pretty straightforward professional style job, and, you know, in those kinds of environments, it's the nature of a corporate is people kind of can keep themselves somewhat contained in things, and it takes a while to get to know people and things like that. But everyone's kind of like tends to be fairly similar education levels, income levels, those kinds of things. And without something like the faction and without a game like Magic to kind of get you involved in the kind of wider perspectives, wider things people like to do with their lives, wider ways they come to the game, just their different perspectives on life. Like, I know I'm definitely a much better and mentally kind of healthier and more appreciative about different aspects of the world because of that, whereas it's very easy to get into your own little bubble, whereas, you know, when you've got a bundle of strongly, like, people with, like, you know, can respectfully deal with each other but have some pretty strong views on a nice wide variety of issues, I think that's actually, like, a really good and healthy thing to be confronted on some of your own biases and things like that you don't necessarily realize you've accrued in your day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's definitely nice to meet and spend time with what is a somewhat diverse group of people and with different views and different worldviews is, I think, definitely a good thing.
Yeah, and also just different backgrounds. Like, you know, we've got relatively younger team members, like, I guess yourself, Ian, who are kind of like, you know, just finished up uni, kind of starting out into the workforce, to I guess people like Hoodie and myself have been working for a while, and then you've got a whole bundle of other people on the team who kind of have kids and families and things, and it's just makes for a really good mix, I feel.
Yeah, and I've definitely benefited from advice from, yeah, people like you or Hoodie or Dan.
But I think this kind of, I mean, what we've got as a microcosm in the team, just to, like, you know, make this not all about the team, really broadens out to the Magic community as a whole. And I think that's the one of those really positive aspects of Magic, is that, you know, basically if you can get your head a bit around this rule set and a bit around how these things interact, you end up meeting all types of people across the table, and that's just part of the beauty of Magic.
Absolutely. Very well put.
Well, I probably should stop rhapsodizing about the values of community and things, because we've certainly been tracking on for a while, so perhaps I hand it through to the two experts, being yourself and Trent, to close things out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on this week, Pete. Always good to get new members, or not new members, rather, but new guests on the Faction podcast. And always really interesting to hear about the community and some of that earlier history with the Faction. Congrats again on your top 4, and Trent, congrats on your top 8. Well done.
I'm just chuffed that he called me an expert. That's great.
I think you've earned the expert title.
Okay. All right. I'll take it. I mean, I'll take it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
We're almost 50 episodes in now.
Wow. Look at us. Look at us go.
I know. Did not expect to get to this point.
Yeah, we've got some exciting ones coming up too. A couple of interviews in the early new mm-hmm. year. Maybe a national champion interview. That'll be exciting.
Ooh. That will be exciting. So you can look forward to that. In the meantime, this is...
No, before you close out, we're going to do the cheeky faction champs one-on-ones and put them together.
I reckon that might be coming, yeah. I reckon we might.
I like the sound of that.
Might put those together.
Have you drawn through from some of the past profiles? I do remember, Trent, I think you did a serious write-up of... tournament reports on one of the early faction champs that you came along to as a judge, and that was absolutely fantastic read. And I remember checking that out going and just being impressed. Like, it's one of those things that's kind of disappeared a bit from Magic literature are those big tournament reports. So whenever you see one, it's just like, oh, this is great.
Yeah, we'll definitely have to do that for this one. I know that we spoke either last week or the week before about our wonderful faction Daniel Papak did a whole bunch of overview and videoing or videography of the people playing and the games and the matches, and we just didn't do anything with it. So this time we will definitely do everything we can with it.
Awesome. Definitely something to look forward to. Well, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. Really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for coming on. Lots exciting to look forward to. This has been the Faction Podcast, and we'll be back next time.
Back next time. Bye, Kyle.